This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
It's Sunday, February 24th. I'm Margaret Brennan, and this is Face the Nation. As North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and President Trump prepare for a second summit, speculation about special counsel Robert Mueller's report intensifies. President Trump reached his conclusion the day the investigation was opened, and he's sticking to it.
It's one of the greatest hoaxes ever perpetrated on this country.
But a former top advisor to the president predicts the report will trigger, quote, a real meat grinder.
I think that 2019 is going to be the most vitriolic year in American politics since before the Civil War.
We'll talk to a Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Missouri's Roy Blunt. And we'll ask Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey, a key voice on North Korea policy in the Senate, about the prospects for any real results out of that summit with Kim Jong-un. And as administration officials assess what funds can be used for the president's border emergency, House Democrats try to stop it. Illinois Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger joins us. He's just back from National Guard service at the border. We'll also check in with two Democratic governors who oppose the president's emergency to build his wall.
We got to bust through some walls to make changes.
New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham and likely 2020 presidential candidate Washington Governor Jay Inslee. All of that and more ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. With the president headed to Vietnam this week, the release of the Mueller report appears to be on hold. But speculation about what's in that report continues. Yesterday, CBS News correspondent Seth Doan spoke with former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon near the Vatican. Bannon, a critic of Pope Francis, was on the sidelines of the papal summit on sex abuse. We'll have a report on that conference later, but first, Seth questions Steve Bannon about the Mueller investigation.
I was someone that told the president many, many times that he should not fire James Comey, that I thought that this collusion investigation was a lot of nonsense and was going to come to naught. Now, I happen to think that the president of the United States, he had full rights and authority to fire Comey. I think you'll see a lot of stuff in the Mueller report. I believe that it'll deal with potential obstruction of justice, and I think it'll come down to decisions that people will think whether the president of the United States, his chief law enforcement officer, has the right to make those decisions or not. But I've been pretty adamant that the collusion thing to me was always essentially a nothing burger, and that the Comey investigation should have just played out.
Looking ahead to campaign 2020, do you think President Trump will see a primary contender?
Oh, definitely. I think definitely from the center, from the Republican Party moderates and from the left of the Republican Party.
Can you stand up to that?
I think it'll be symbolic. I don't think it'll be serious. I think we have to get through 2019. I think the next 90 days to 4 months is going to be a real meat grinder. I think you have the Mueller report coming out. You have what's happening on this investigation on the inaugural committee. You have the Southern District of New York. You have other investigations going on. I mean, the pressure on the president is coming from many different angles. I think you've already seen it from what the Democrats, some of these reports they've been dropping here without telling anybody. I think that now that they control the House, they can weaponize this. They can weaponize the Mueller report. I think that 2019 is going to be the most vitriolic year in American politics since before the Civil War. And I include Vietnam in that. I think we're in for a very nasty 2019. I think what comes down the other side of that, then you can position yourself for 2020.
And you think the president can come out of 2019 in a much weaker position?
No, I think he comes out in a much more battle-hardened position. I think it's going to be a very tough 4 or 5 months for the president. I think it's for the team around him, but I think it'll get him very focused.
You think the RNC is doing enough to protect Mr. Trump?
I think the RNC is, I had a good experience with the RNC during the campaign. I'm a little disappointed in 2018. I think the focus should have been on the House. I think there's no reason we should have lost the House. I think the RNC and the Trump campaign should have maniacally focused on the House to make sure we weren't in the situation now with these investigations and with the ability to weaponize the Mueller report. So they have to get better than they were in 18, because 18, I think they let the president down. They got to get better for 20, and I think every indication they are.
Bannon also said that as of now, he has, quote, zero doubt that the president will run again. But he stressed that we are about to enter an extraordinary time in American politics. We begin with Missouri Republican Senator Roy Blunt, who sits on the Intelligence Committee, which has been conducting their own investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 campaign. It certainly feels extraordinary, Senator, in terms of the time we are in. But you heard Steve Bannon there say that he thinks the meat of this Mueller report is going to be about obstruction of justice. Have you felt any pressure from the president when it comes to the Senate investigation?
Have not. And actually, because we have been involved in that investigation now for almost 2 years, I think most of the members on the Intelligence Committee have been very thoughtful in the way they approach both the president and the administration on this issue. I think the pressure from the president is the same pressure we all feel, which is let's get this over with. It would have been the reason not to slow down the investigation, as Mr. Bannon said, to change the leaders. But at the same time, when you look at how Director Comey had handled things the previous year with the Clinton investigation, the determination, I'm going to say that she did a lot of bad things, but none of them are worthy of indictment. One of those two things was a mistake, but probably the biggest mistake was not reporting directly to the Attorney General rather than to take this new obligation on himself to decide what was right and what was wrong. So I understand that, but I've always been of the view that anything that slows down the investigation is not a good thing, that we need to get the facts out there, get this behind us in a way that people thought that anybody that should have been talked to was talked to, any question that should have been asked was asked. And we've been trying to do that in the Senate committee, I think, in a very appropriate way. And remember, Cohen, who'll be testifying both to our committee privately and the House, I think, publicly next week.
It's the president's long-term.
One of the charges against him was lying to Senate investigators when he was asked questions, and that's totally unacceptable.
Well, so he lied last time to Congress. He's admitted to that. Why are you having him back, and why do you believe him this time?
Well, I don't know that we believe him this time. We'll just have to see. I think the reason you have him back is when somebody lies to Congress in an investigation like this, the questions you might have asked the next witness don't get asked. Somebody you might have called doesn't get called. It's serious well beyond whatever Cohen might have said in that you misdirect the investigation. That's why it's so important that those kinds of charges be taken very seriously. And obviously they are, and he's going to go to jail because of it.
Do you have any concerns that your investigation is too narrow? I mean, Michael Cohen is now working with Manhattan prosecutors on some alleged financial crimes and questions about inaugural committee, which, as you heard Steve Bannon says, is the bigger issue, he thinks.
Well, I think, Margaret, the problem with all these investigations, which is why we don't do that totally independent special counsel anymore, Democrats and Republicans let that lapse, is not that they're too narrow, but they get too broad. I'm not sure that George Washington's expense account could stand up against the entire force of the federal government if you looked at everything related to everything, as opposed to really focusing on what was supposed to be the charge here, which is collusion. Our Chairman Burr said 2 or 3 weeks ago that we have so far found no evidence of collusion. And you can see everybody backpedaling now, House and Senate both, on the idea that collusion is going to be in the report. They want to come up with lots of other things that I think are going to be much more arguable than a pure finding of collusion would have been, because I don't think that's there.
That was an interview with CBS News, and it was the comment from Senator Burr was, if it was written now, there was no evidence of collusion. But as you say, your committee's still investigating.
We are still, and you know, we'd like to have, frankly, a little more access to the Mueller investigation before we come to a final conclusion. His report will help us write our final report. We've given Mueller full access to all of our interviews, all of our investigation. We haven't had that reciprocated, and so we'll soon find out what else is out there that we might not know about.
Well, on that report, the House Intel Chairman Adam Schiff told ABC this morning that Democrats are going to subpoena that Mueller report if it is not made public, and to expect that the special counsel will be called to testify. Should we expect him to testify in front of the Senate? And can you actually enforce a subpoena to get the Justice Department to do something that they refused to do in the first place?
I don't know that you can. And, the new Attorney General, Bill Barr, was very specific on this when asked during his confirmation what should happen, what should be released, what shouldn't be released. Should you release things you find out that don't lead to an indictment or might not lead to an indictment in the future? Should you release things that people did that are merely embarrassing? You know, the weight of the government here is very strong, and people need to think about that when they begin to demand, we need to know whatever you found out, whether it led anywhere or not.
And we should expect Mueller to testify before your committee in public?
I think we'll have to wait and see what's in the report.
I want to also ask you about this declaration of the national emergency that the president made.
Right.
Do you think Republican leadership in the Senate will allow for a vote on a resolution to try to block the emergency declaration? We know the House is moving forward
right.
with one.
I don't think we have a choice. I think the way that 74 law was written, the House has a vote, then we have to have a vote. It's a privileged motion. If it's written correctly, and I don't have any reason to believe they won't write it correctly. I don't know yet. I don't know yet. I don't like the process. I don't think that the emergency declaration law was written to deal with things that the president asked the Congress to do and then the Congress didn't do. It's never been used that way before. I want to look carefully at the law. I want to hear what the president's lawyers have to say about it. I really think the president would have been better served by, one, taking the money that he got in the bill he signed, two, using the transfer authority he had, and I am absolutely confident that those two amounts of money would be more money than could be spent between now and September the 30th. I think it's an unfortunate decision.
That's practically speaking, but in terms of clarifying what you just said, are you saying it is possible that what the president declared is unconstitutional?
No.
You believe he has full authorities to do this,
to bypass
the power of the purse strings with Congress to achieve a policy outcome that Congress refused to deliver on?
No, I think there is a likelihood that he is within the law that Congress passed. But, you know, that was long before I got to the Congress. I haven't, no president has used that law this way before. I think we're going to have to evaluate whether this is really the intention of an emergency. Is it really an emergency if, again, the president asked the Congress to do it and they failed to? That's different than the way this law has been used in the past.
So you could vote to try to block the president from moving forward with this emergency. You just haven't decided yet. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. It's also fair to understand that the president says he'll veto whatever
right.
passes the House and Senate. And so this will be decided in the courts. I think it's highly unlikely that the veto would be overridden in the House and probably not overridden in the Senate, either one. And so it's going to be decided in the courts. And I think it's a significant court decision.
Senator, thank you very much.
By the way, let me say on this, I do agree with what the president is trying to do here. I just mm-hmm. think there is a more likely way to get it done.
And it's an important conversation about how our government functions. So I want to turn now to a Massachusetts Democrat, Senator Ed Markey, who is the top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee responsible for U.S. policy on North Korea. But before we get there, I'd like you to weigh in on this declaration of a national emergency. Is Congress powerless to stop the president?
It's a clear usurpation of congressional authority. There will be a resolution of disapproval, which most likely will pass in the House of Representatives this week. Then it will come over to the United States Senate. It's uncertain whether there are enough.
Well, the president says he's going to veto it.
And then even if there are a small handful of Republicans who are willing to vote for that resolution of disapproval, the president says that he's going to veto it. And then it will come back to the House and Senate. And I believe it's highly unlikely that there will be two-thirds of the House and Senate who will vote that way, given the mm-hmm. base support of the Republican Party for President Trump and his actions. And then it will go to the courts. And I think in the courts, we're going to have a very strong case that this is an unconstitutional action by the president usurping an authority which was deliberately built into the Constitution by the Founding Fathers to ensure that there was a separation of powers, that there was a check and balance on a president so that they could not act unilaterally.
And that is the bigger point, I think, for viewers to understand, that this seems all procedural, bureaucratic talk in Washington, but that bigger purpose of how our government is supposed to function and how it is the question here. In the past, under President Obama, you were supportive of his use of executive authority on a number of different fronts, including immigration. Do you regret that now, and why is it different what President Trump is, how he's using it?
The clear difference here is that the Congress, House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans, just reached an agreement on funding for border security. They just finished it, and they sent it to the president. A president cannot use his executive authority, his emergency authority, when none exist, when Congress just finished acting on it, when they provided money for the president to provide additional security along the border. So, no, this is a new area that the president, which President Trump has now entered. It's not Hurricane Katrina. It's not after 9/11. This is something quite substantial, which would have precedential value when a Democrat is president. And I think Republicans should be very, very cautious in allowing for President Trump to take this authority, because it would lead to a very significant diminution of the authority of the Congress in the future when any president, Democrat or Republican, seek to act.
North Korea, as we said, you watch Asia policy very carefully here. A number of leading national security-minded Democrats have released a letter saying that the administration is just not sharing information at all on the diplomacy underway. What are your thoughts on that? What do you need to know?
Well, right now, it's pretty clear that Kim wants to have a personal meeting with Trump, with hopes that he can, in fact, elicit concessions from President Trump that otherwise might not be possible if it was just our diplomats talking one-on-one. So I think there's apprehension, in fact, amongst President Trump's own diplomats heading into this summit. Nothing is clear. And I think as a result, we could run the risk that Kim is given concessions which are not accompanied by real concessions that the United States is receiving in return from Kim and his regime.
You're saying the president's going to get played?
I think that he has to be very careful going in. He has to make sure.
Specifically, what does that mean? What is Congress most concerned about? Is it troops on the peninsula? The president has said he's not looking to withdraw them.
Well, he's looking for a declaration to the end of the Korean War. He's looking for other concessions. But I think that in order to be sure that this summit is, in fact, successful, the president should first return with a codification of the freezing of the missile program and nuclear program in North Korea. That testing should not continue. Second, that there should be a verifiable program of inspection of the entire nuclear program in North Korea. And third, that there should be a roadmap which is put in place to ensure that no concessions made by the United States, for example, in lifting of sanctions, occurs without verifiable evidence that Kim is complying step by step with the denuclearization of North Korea.
Very quickly, is there a risk to Democrats weaponizing the Mueller report, as Bannon accused Democrats of doing?
The Democrats have a responsibility to make sure that there was not a compromise of the presidential election of 2016. If the Attorney General takes the Mueller report and then sanitizes it and releases that as the answer to a comprehensive investigation, then I think the Democrats in the House and Senate, along with Republicans, have a responsibility to ensure that the American people know what happened in 2016. What was the relationship between the Trump campaign and the Russian government? Was there any subsequent relationship in the post-election period? We don't know the answers to those questions. The Mueller report potentially gives us those answers, and it's going to be critical that the American public knows what happened in 2016. Right now, Everything rides on that Mueller report and the Attorney General, William Barr, not sanitizing it in a way that is not transparent to the public. And the Congress, the Democrats, have a responsibility to do that job.
Senator Markey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Are you having trouble sleeping? NFL players have been coached. Blue light from smart devices, it can affect your sleep. They'll even wear blue blocker glasses in the evening for improved sleep. Others will try tart cherry juice and smoothies. Not only can it help fight inflammation, but to help you sleep, it's got high amounts of natural melatonin that's beneficial for sleep. The other night, my girlfriend told me I was snoring way too much and even the earplugs weren't helping. So the next day, she took me to the Sleep Number store because if I was snoring, at least she could get a good night's sleep on a Sleep Number bed. Sleep Number beds allow you to adjust on each side to your ideal firmness, comfort, and support. The Sleep Number 360 smart bed senses your movement and automatically adjusts to keep you sleeping comfortably through the night. With Sleep IQ technology inside the bed, it tracks how you're sleeping so you can know every morning how well you've slept and gain insights for your best sleep. Experience the smart, effortless comfort of the Sleep Number 360 smart bed. Find your competitive edge with proven quality sleep from $999. Sleep Number is the official sleep and wellness partner of the NFL. You'll only find Sleep Number at one of their 575 Sleep Number stores nationwide. Find the one nearest you at sleepnumber.com/cadence. That's sleepnumber.com/CADENCE. Sleep Number.
Nearly all U.S. governors are here in Washington this weekend for the National Governors Association Conference, and two Democrats join us now, New Mexico's Michelle Lujan Grisham and Washington State's Jay Inslee. Welcome to Face the Nation. Great to have you here in person.
Thank you.
Governor, we played that extraordinary video that you busting through walls here. We know you do not support the president's border wall and his emergency declaration of one. Explain to our viewers why you withdrew the National Guard troops from your border with Mexico.
Because as everyone ought to be doing, right, I was on the border and I'm looking and assessing whether or not there's a real emergency or crisis, and there isn't. And the reality is that these troops need to be available when there is a serious issue or an emergency to deal with. Now, interestingly enough, given the fact that the president's policies along the border, including the wall, have created real issues for humanitarian efforts for asylum seekers. So I did place some National Guard, law enforcement, and most importantly, health responders to an area where they're forcing them to come across a really desolate area in the southern part of the state.
Because you see there the record number of families crossing.
Children
even
and
though
mothers.
Overall apprehensions is at a 50-year low.
Way down. But when you don't let anybody seek asylum the way that they're supposed to, or you grant visas on the front end, you're asking people to take an even more dangerous journey and show up. And, you know, they voluntarily give themselves to Border Patrol. So we're making sure that the right kinds of services so that we don't have children who die right at those border areas in that crossing ever again in our state.
Governor, Washington State has not brought suit against the administration. There are about 16 states that have challenged the president's emergency declaration. Will you?
Yes. The moment that the administration jeopardizes any federal expenditure in our state, we will file suit. And we feel good about our chances to succeed. We have done so. I'm proud to be the first governor to sue to stop the Muslim ban. And we are happy, though, of judicial system to rein in this president. Look, I think it is obviously the situation here. We do not have a national security emergency. Donald Trump has a political emergency.
That's right.
He was unable to get Mexico to pay for his wall. He does not have the support of either party. And the entire U.S. Congress, on a bipartisan basis, have told him his wall is a colossal mistake. He ought to be responding to real emergencies like the forest fires. We just came from a meeting with the cabinet members asking for help with the federal government with our forest fires. And climate change is burning down our forests. That's an emergency where we ought to have the help of the federal government. We don't have it.
And the governor pointed out something really important. For my state, it's $150 million that we stand to lose by virtue of his national declaration for an emergency that doesn't exist. And now he's harming our military assets this doesn't make any sense, and it's completely inappropriate to a state like
this. Well, I'll ask you more about what monies he is using, but Governor Inslee, you just said, though, that you would be open to declaring a national emergency based on climate. So how do you define when the president has the constitutional authority to declare an emergency if you say on the grounds of the border crisis, as he deems it, it's unconstitutional?
So I believe under our current system of democracy, this action by this president is illegal and unconstitutional. That's what I believe. And I think Republicans ought to stand up on their hind legs because they took an oath to the Constitution, not to Donald Trump, and reverse this decision. If that doesn't happen, we need the judicial system to reverse this decision. But ultimately, in responding to the climate change emergency, we need to work together, executive and legislative branch. But if there are new rules, the Republicans have to understand that Democrats will play by whatever the rules are, particularly when it comes to climate change.
I'm going to come back to that because I can't let it sit there, but we are going to have to take a break. So you got a few minutes to stay with us here, both of you governors, if you would. Stay with us. We hope all of you will, too. We'll be back in a moment.
Memories make us laugh and cry.
And sometimes cringe when we look back at our fashion choices.
But in between flashbacks of bowl cuts and dad jeans, our memories are fading, and so is the old media that holds them. Hi, I'm Adam Baselager.
And I'm Nick Mocco, and we're the founders of Legacy Box.
Legacy Box is the easiest and safest way to preserve your family memories.
Here's how it works. Fill Legacy Box with your outdated media. We professionally digitize and send them back on DVDs, thumb drive, or the cloud.
Look, those forgotten home movies, VHS tapes, film reels, and photos are degrading right before your eyes.
Experience peace of mind and enjoy reliving the glory days. Join more than 500,000 families who have already trusted Legacy Box.
Save your memories today. Visit legacybox.com/save. And for a limited time, get 40% off your order. That's legacybox.com/save for 40% off. Legacybox.com/save.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. More now with two Democratic governors, New Mexico's Michelle Lujan Grisham and Washington State's Jay Inslee. Let's pick up where we left off. Governor Inslee, should a president be able to declare a national emergency in pursuit of a policy goal or not?
Well, not if it is in clear contravention of the law passed by the United States Congress. There are provisions where emergencies require executive authority, where Congress has not been able to act, where they're out of town, and they need emergency responses. But it clearly is a contravention of basic norms of American democracy for Congress to pass an appropriation bill, identify what is legal and illegal, have the president say he just disagrees with that, and countermand the entire authority of the United States Congress. We cannot allow that to happen. And we need Republicans to show just a little bit of strength of character for the American Constitution when they vote on this in a week or so.
And there's not an emergency at the border. And so the effort here on this political punting by Republicans and action by the president is really outrageous because they're sowing fear, racism, hate, and discrimination. And it's all based on a president who has no intention of dealing with immigration policy or foreign policy in a productive way. He wants this wall, and he's lying to the American people. And that is also outrageous.
But there's also no sign that Congress would actually take any action on immigration reform at all. When it comes to the question of the National Guard troops, which you made that call to bring them back from the New Mexico border, obviously you're border state governor. You see what's happening in your state. Over 36,000 people in your state signed a petition to impeach you after you made this call. So do you think that your constituents' concerns here are being heard?
Well, let's talk about the folks who are impacted in the counties where we're seeing folks have to migrate because they can't do asylum for humanitarian issues. Every single elected official in that county is with us on making sure that we address the problems that they really have, communications, road maintenance, making sure that we're providing health care and health emergency services, giving them law enforcement. And in fact, Congress did do that in both this appropriation bill, and quite frankly, Congress did. It passed a DREAM Act before I was elected to Congress. There's been some meaningful immigration reform. There was meaningful bipartisan negotiation on the USA Act. But all that this administration said unequivocally unless they just get a wall, they're not interested in any of those other policies. And it's really created huge burdens for states like mine to use evidence-based efforts to secure the border and to deal with real issues.
Governor Inslee, you are expected to potentially make a bid to be the next commander-in-chief. When are you actually going to make a decision on whether you're running?
At the right moment, but it'll be soon.
Which is when?
And we're happy to talk to you. Just at the right moment, it will be soon.
I think you said weeks, not months.
We're coming up to another week. Stay tuned.
We are, certainly. Are you expecting it this week?
It could be as soon as that. And what we are seeing right now, and I've been pleased by what I've been hearing across the country, that people do want a president that will act on a real emergency, which is climate change. We're very proud of our New Mexico governor, who's building a clean energy economy, to respond to a real emergency, which is climate change. Mm-hmm. But she and the other governors, look, we're fighting real emergencies, the forest fires that are consuming the western United States. They need a president who will rally the nation to a clean energy economy,
right,
jobs by the millions, and save this country from that damage.
Governors, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Studio. And we're going to turn now to Illinois Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who's in Chicago, but he is just freshly back from the border. He was serving with the Air National Guard at the border, where he was flying surveillance missions out of Tucson, Arizona. Congressman, this wasn't your first border deployment. It's the first one under the national emergency. Does it constitute a national emergency?
Yeah, I think it does. You know, I went down there kind of undecided. You know, I put on my lieutenant colonel hat, was apolitical, but obviously I'm looking at this, getting the information I can. And I think if this was just an issue of immigration, it wouldn't constitute a national emergency. But what I saw was really disturbing. Let me give you just a couple quick examples. And I was just a small part of all the operations that were being done. We found at one point a woman hunkered down in the desert because her coyotes who brought her over deserted her because they wanted to get away. Had she actually not been found by us, I don't know if she'd have been able to find her way home. So yeah, she got picked up by Border Patrol. She's going to be deported. But that was a way better option than being one of the 200 at least bodies they end up finding in the desert every year. And keep in mind, I've done this. You know, we had a mission where we found 70 pounds of methamphetamines on somebody that was coming over. And I'm just a very small part of that. This is the fourth time I've been to the border, my first time in Arizona, completely different terrain than my prior in Texas. Texas, by the way, I was there under President Obama. So the Guard's mission on the border is nothing new.
But border apprehensions are near a 50-year low. So when you're talking about an emergency and you have border state governors tell you that's just not what they're seeing, how do you justify sending as much as 6,000 active duty troops?
Well, what I didn't see is a low in apprehension. I mean, there were beyond.
That's according to Customs and Border Patrol.
That's fine. That's fine. I'm saying from my experience, there were many, many groups that we would see on technology with camera, radar, or something like that, that we could not go address because there were not enough Border Patrol agents. These agents sometimes left to take a truck and then walk 2 miles through terrible terrain to get to these groups, only to have them run while they're already exhausted and they get lost in that chaos. So is it down? Maybe. Part of that's because now they've understood how to abuse the asylum laws in this country. You have a lot of folks from countries that are not declaring asylum in Mexico where they should be because it's the first country where they can actually declare safety. And coming here, they've learned how to do that. So now you have this crisis basically of, which I don't think the actual migration or the calling for asylum is in and of itself a crisis, but you now have a massive amount of people doing that. But I'll tell you what I saw was a lot of people coming over the border, a lot of drugs in the border, and a lot of human trafficking. I mean, these coyotes that would get paid a lot of money to bring groups over and then desert them to save their own backside.
So am I understanding, the picture you're painting, am I understanding that you believe the president's declaration of a national emergency is constitutional and that you will not vote to try to block it?
Yeah, I won't vote to try to block it. Look, I wish this would have happened a different way. I voted for comprehensive immigration reform. I think Republicans and Democrats both have good ideas on immigration.
But you think this is constitutional for the president to bypass the power of the purse strings of Congress?
Yes, because in this case, like I said at the beginning, if this was just about immigration, I would disagree. I do think this is a security threat. It's a security threat with the amount of drugs coming over the border and the human trafficking that I've seen. And again, in Arizona, I think they said last year there were 200 bodies at least that they found in the desert. Mm-hmm. It is not compassionate, as your prior guest said, to basically say, we're not going to do border security because, in essence, would encourage people to come across the border. It's compassionate to say, do it the right way. Do it. We're going to have a secure border. We're going to have an immigration system that is welcoming, which I fully believe in, doing it the right way instead of forcing, in some cases, very innocent people to pay the drug cartels, to pay the cartels money, to coyote them into a very dangerous part of this country, mm-hmm. and then abandon them when the heat gets too
high. Well, there's plenty of debate about whether that would actually stop demand for drugs or stop people from trying to come across. But let me ask you about something else I know you're concerned about, and that is Syria. Is 400 mm-hmm. U.S. troops enough to leave behind in Syria to counter all the threats that they are going to be asked to face?
Well, I certainly wish it was more than that. I am glad that the president has reversed this decision. I think 2,000 troops was a great example, frankly, of how we're doing war in the 21st century, which is legitimizing the local folks and using our special forces to give them the combat power necessary. Leaving that amount of troops there is good for blocking Iran's position in Syria, for getting intelligence from folks on the ground to see any rise of ISIS that inevitably is going to come again. I wish it was more, but I am glad that the president reversed his decision. Syria is a mess. Iran's position there is a mess. And I actually worry about the future, not just of Syria, but the future of a potential regional conflict in this area with all these folks there.
But the concern there is that the special operators who are there right now are going to then be transitioned to some kind of murky term, a peacekeeping force, and that they'll be facing an inordinate amount of risk. The Pentagon seemed caught flat-footed by this declaration.
Yeah, I think there's definitely more risk. Our special ops are really good. I doubt they're going to be going out and doing combat patrols, more leveling, using the local forces to get done what they need to get done, intelligence gathering. We'll have great air support for them. But anytime you have a smaller group there, they are put in danger. There is no country that would be dumb enough to attack our forces there. But, of course, we've seen even recently with ISIS, their boldness in attacking American military. That's why we have to stay on the offense. There's going to be an ISIS II someday. There's going to be an Al-Qaeda III. It's a generational fight. It's not just through war. It's giving hope to the next generation of folks in the Middle East to reject that ideology within their own religion.
Congressman, good to talk to you. Plenty more to get to, but we have to leave it there for today.
You bet. Take care.
We'll be right back with our political panel.
What's your next adventure? Everyone deserves a chance to do what they love. Pacific Life helps you reach financial goals while you go after your personal ones. Plans change over time, and your financial solutions can too. Pacific Life has a variety of financial solutions that can help you complement your life goals and passions while managing the uncertainties. Backed by more than 150 years of experience, you can count on Pacific Life to be there so you can go out and keep living your best life. Pacific Life is one of the most dependable and experienced insurers in the industry and has been named one of the 2019 World's Most Ethical Companies by the Ethisphere Institute. The freedom to go after whatever is next for you? That's the power of Pacific. Ask a financial professional about how Pacific Life can help give you the freedom to do what you love, or visit www.pacificlife.com.
We want to bring in now our panel for some political analysis. Edward Wong is a diplomatic and international correspondent for The New York Times. Susan Page is the Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. Jamal Simmons is a host on Hill TV and a Democratic strategist. And Ben Domenech is the founder and publisher of The Federalist. A lot to get to with all of you. Susan, 2020 and the picture that we heard, Steve Bannon, the longtime White House strategist and ally for President Trump, really sketched out a number of interesting things, including the fact that he thinks there could be a primary challenger to the president from within the Republican Party.
Yes, he said there definitely will. He said it will be symbolic. But, you know, symbolic challenges to incumbent presidents can be really damaging. Ask George H.W. Bush, ask Jimmy Carter, the impact of having a primary challenge, even one that doesn't take the nomination away from you. I think this is a subject that should be probably of more concern to the White House than it is, because there's not really a question at this time that President Trump will retain the Republican nomination. But these primary fights can be brutal.
And Ben, you had Governor Hogan indicate that he thinks there should be a primary challenger.
Yeah, but I don't think that Bannon is correct about how this would play out. The fact is that unlike a situation with George H.W. Bush, polling consistently shows that the Republican Party is overwhelmingly in favor of the president, that they back him overwhelmingly. Sure, there could be a symbolic challenge in some way, but there's unlikely to be one that could get between the president and the base of the Republican Party, which is why Pat Buchanan's challenge, for instance, in 92 was so damaging to President Bush.
Yeah, here's what's so weird about it to me, right? Usually when somebody runs against an incumbent president, they run from the ideological fringe of that party, or the ideological wing of that party, right? Ted Kennedy ran from the liberal left. Pat Buchanan ran from kind of the Trump right, is really what it is, right? But this would be kind of a centrist challenge to a president. I don't know that we've ever seen someone run from the center against a president. What may occur is that that person's job may be to help organize who the anti-Trump forces are inside the Republican Party and identify that person for the Democrats, that those may be potential Democratic voters that could be won over.
And then there's the question for the Democrats of where's your center, right?
Yeah.
Because we haven't seen Joe Biden, who's expected to declare, jump in, or any of the other names. You had Governor Inslee here saying, oh, maybe this week I'll make a decision. And you have that extraordinary Time magazine cover this week reflecting what we're seeing, which is just about everyone is running. What do you make of the field? Where is the center?
Well, here's why Democrats should be thankful to Bernie Sanders, because Bernie Sanders showed that there was a real passion on the Democratic left to find somebody who was going to not argue about how much we should cut taxes for the wealthy, but maybe we should be raising taxes on the wealthy, or maybe we should be trying to figure out how do we cover more people with Medicare or get more expanded daycare. So he's opened up that entire lane. Now, what could also be true is, you know, Facebook wasn't the first social media company. There was MySpace and there was Friendster before that. Bernie Sanders might be the MySpace and Friendster of the Democratic Party, right, where he's helped show us that there's this path. And then what comes after that is a Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren or somebody like that who really takes advantage of the opening.
But the effect of that has been that you've had all of these candidates, even including ones who could run to the center, tacking to the left in significant ways. I mean, the fact is that the majority of the Democratic cast endorsed the Green New Deal. The majority of the Democratic cast is completely backing abortion policies on the state level that are widely out of sync, not just with Americans, but with pro-choice Americans, polling indicates. That leaves an opening for the president to do the kinds of things that he did in the State of the Union, which is to frame the Democrats as the party of the extreme. He's going to continue to do that, and that's going to be, frankly, a way to keep those types of centrists that you talked about within the GOP who might be open to a Democratic candidacy away from them and loyal to the Republican Party.
There's an ideological debate in the Democratic Party, no question. There are centrists there, and there are all people who endorse the Green New Deal. But one thing that unites the Democratic Party is that they want to win in 2020. And when you go out and talk to voters, there is no issue that they care about more than that one.
Ed, I want to ask you, one thing that we see lacking on many of the resumes of the candidates is foreign policy experience. You haven't heard a lot of views of what they think America's role in the world should be. Crisis in Venezuela is sort of forcing people to take a stand. Possibly this North Korea summit may force some of these candidates to describe foreign policy. What is it that you're seeing out there?
Well, I think that there are certain issues that candidates will be forced to address. Security is one of them. And so they'll criticize Trump, I think, for his take on North Korea and for the fact that we haven't made much progress on North Korea and its nuclear program since the first summit. And they'll question why we're holding these series of summits when Kim hasn't met the promises that he set out. Another big question is China and trade. And I think that we'll see talk about whether his approach to China and to the trade deficit and to other issues related to the economy is the right one.
And you have that March 2nd deadline looming
right,
in terms of the president ramping up tariffs potentially, and that extraordinary exchange in the Oval Office where you saw a divide between the president and his chief negotiator over laying out the terms in front of the Chinese.
Right. My read on that was that Lighthizer, the chief negotiator, is nervous that the president will undermine the American negotiating position by pushing back on the idea of what an MOU means.
I think there's a memorandum of understanding.
Right. And I think there is debate among experts about whether the president's right or whether Lighthizer was right in that. But having the president sort of go right against the trade negotiator in front of the television cameras is not good for the American negotiating position.
My first job in Washington was working for the U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor, and I just cannot believe Bill Clinton would have ever upbraided Mickey Cantor in front of the Chinese negotiator and the entire public. Usually,
the Chinese negotiator usually wants
your negotiator to have the strongest hand possible when they go into the deal. That's not what he's doing. One other point, you mentioned people who aren't talking about foreign policy. I think Kamala Harris yesterday came out for temporary protective status for Venezuelans in this particular crisis that's happening down there.
You know, I think that the exchange that you saw over memorandums of understanding in China was a little bit of a red flag to the diplomats who are concerned about the summit mm-hmm. with North Korea, because there is concern that the president does not pay attention to what he sees as diplomatic niceties that diplomats see as absolutely crucial, and some concern that you heard articulated in your interview with Senator Markey that he will agree to a deal that looks good in the moment, helps him in the moment, but isn't really sustainable, doesn't have verification, offers the North Koreans too much for what they give us. This might be a sign of something to come.
The North Koreans are not going to give up their nuclear program. They just aren't.
You agree with U.S. intelligence, then.
I mean, the thing to understand is just that, I mean, you can, when it comes to this summit, you can take the under. This mm-hmm. is not going to be something that produces a massive breakthrough. It is going to be something that is going to be spun in the public, in a lot of different ways. But just in terms of what our expectations should be, they have to be tempered by the reality of what's going to be really on the table when it comes to the North Korean offer. And frankly, they're in the driver's seat.
And Ed, you had some reporting on this. We have the Secretary of State out there on a number of TV networks today lowering expectations. You say now that he's doing it publicly, you have reporting on what he's saying privately. And what is that?
Right. He's saying privately that within at least in his time in office, maybe the president's time in office, they might not get to full denuclearization. He tells us to Korea experts and to others that he talks to off the record. And I think that's, as Ben says, that might be the realistic outlook on where we can get to with North Korea. There might be very minimal work on the nuclear program. There might be some work, but not full denuclearization. And the big question that we have to ask is whether at what point would the United States publicly accept a nuclear North Korea and acknowledge that, just as it accepts Israel, Pakistan, and other countries having nuclear weapons?
Normalization of North Korea, no longer a pariah state.
Right. Well, Trump did say he fell in love. He and Kim fell in love, so maybe we'll have that going forward.
Yeah, and you had the odds at, 60% of what the U.S.'s demands they'll likely get?
Right. That's what Pompeo has told some people.
That seems pretty high.
Right. I mean, North Korea has around 30 to 60 nuclear warheads already right now. And every 6 months, it makes enough fissile material for another warhead. So experts think it's going forward with the program right now, even as diplomacy is continuing. And it will be hard to get it fully dismantled.
We should consider, of course, the withdrawal from the INF as being part of this conversation as well. I know that was mostly framed.
The arms control agreement.
Yes. I know that was mostly framed in the context of our relationship with Russia. But the overwhelming agreement on the part of our European allies is that Russia has been in violation of this for years anyway. Mm-hmm. And much of the INF is actually restricting us when it comes to what we can do vis-a-vis the Asian situation, both with China and with North Korea. It could be something that could be interesting potentially down the road in terms of the types of responses that we could put in place that would have been banned under the INF.
And Susan, last word to you. A real meat grinder is how Steve Bannon described the next 4 to 5 months.
Yeah.
What should we be girding ourselves for?
We say this every week, but this is really going to be a crucial week. We're going to have North Korea summit and a split screen with Michael Cohen testifying before Congress. And we've got Bob Mueller standing in the doorway with his report to come out soon. It's going to be a remarkable few months. It's going to be a remarkable week or two ahead.
Let's not forget the underlying question that Mueller has, which is, did the president collude with the Russians?
We got to leave it there. And we will be back in a moment with a report on the Catholic Church's sex abuse summit.
I used to think that all diet and weight loss plans were the same. Well, not anymore, because I found Noom. Noom is a new and totally different approach to losing weight and getting healthy that uses psychology and small goals to help change your habits. So it's easy to lose the weight and keep it off for good. Noom combines the power of technology with real human support, offering as little or as much help as you want along the way. And since Noom is an app, it's always with you and easy to use, which makes it super easy to stay on track and reach your goals. Plus, it's really simple to get started. Just go online, answer a few quick questions, and they'll create a personalized program just for you. Noom helped me lose my old way of thinking about food and dieting. So what do you have to lose? Visit Noom.com/podcast NOOM.com/podcast and start your 14-day trial today. Like they say, change your habits, change your mind, and change for good with Noom.
Over the past 4 days, senior bishops gathered at the Vatican for a landmark summit on clergy sex abuse convened by Pope Francis. It comes after years of controversy for the Catholic Church. CBS News correspondent Seth Doan is in Rome with what was decided.
Pope Francis spoke of the abuse of power that lies at the center of clerical sex abuse, turning priests into tools of Satan. The brutality of this worldwide phenomenon becomes all the more grave and scandalous in the Church, the pontiff said, for it is utterly incompatible with its moral authority and ethical credibility. Francis widened the scope of the problem past clerical sex abuse to include the many threats to minors, including child pornography and child soldiers, and added, no abuse should be covered up, as was often the case in the past. The pontiff presented a list of 8 so-called best practices. Points included sparing no effort in protecting children, purifying the church in part through training in seminaries, strengthening rules, supporting victims, and being aware of threats in the digital world.
The Pope's speech today, can you give it a grade?
Disappointing. Incomplete. I was hoping for something more pastoral, something more forceful.
Father Thomas Rees is a senior analyst with Religion News Service.
Did we learn anything new, anything concrete in this?
I don't think that people in America, if they looked at the speech, would find anything new. Remember, this meeting was primarily focused on parts of the world where they don't think they have a crisis.
Rules are already in place for priests, so one of the big questions here was how to close the loopholes in laws for the higher-ranking bishops, accused, among other things, of carrying out or covering up abuse.
How do we hold accountable bishops? That's what American people are. Where's the system? How do we punish bishops that don't do what they're supposed to do?
Do we have any new answers?
Not at this meeting. Not yet.
All along, Margaret, the Vatican has stressed that follow-up will be key. And in a press conference this afternoon, they told us to expect some more details in the coming weeks, including a document written by the Pope and a handbook for bishops about how to handle cases of abuse.
Seth Doan in Rome. That's it for us today. Thank you for watching. I'll see you this week for North Korea summit coverage from Vietnam. For Face the Nation, I'm Margaret Brennan. Today's guests were Missouri Republican Senator Roy Blunt, Massachusetts Democratic Senator Ed Markey, Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, and Democratic Governors Michelle Lujan Grisham of New Mexico and Jay Inslee of Washington State. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. This broadcast was directed by Allison Hawley. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can...
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money, and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.
It was the biggest scandal in pop music. The stars of Milli Vanilli, the Grammy-winning multi-platinum R&B phenomenon, were exposed as frauds. But none of this was their idea. So whose idea was it? Enter German music producer Frank Farian. He saw the success of acts like Michael Jackson and Prince, and he wanted in, no matter the cost. So he devised the perfect pop heist. 2 once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? They couldn't sing. But Frank knew just how to fix that. Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies and takes a never-before-heard look at the exploitation of 2 young Black artists. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when the truth came out, Rob and Fab were the only ones who got burned. Looking back now, it's hard not to wonder, why did everyone blame them and not the man pulling the strings? Follow Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
The Hargan women seem to have it all.
From the outside looking in, we were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But as detectives would soon learn, there was a lot going on inside the Hargan household.
Ashley and I have been calling my mom and the house and Helen. Okay. No one's answering.
63-year-old Pamela Hargan gunned down in her own home. Her youngest daughter, Helen, lay dead upstairs.
Patrol, when they arrived, assumed or thought that there might have been a murder-suicide.
But for the detectives on the scene,
there were things about the scene itself that were concerning to us on day one.
Who would want to kill their mother and their little sister?
There is no boogeyman here. It is exactly who we think it is.
I'm Peter Van Sant from 48 Hours. This is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.